Coming to you inside the massive outdoor retailer trade show in Denver, this is Go West Young Podcast, your show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss. Welcome to the first in a series of episodes that we will be recording live on the road, although in this case the road is about a half mile down from CWP World Headquarters in Denver. We will be heading out of state later this summer, though, so keep those episode ideas coming. Send them to podcast@westernpriorities.org. Now, as you probably guessed by our location, this week we are going to be talking about the outdoor recreation economy. We have a state legislator from New Mexico, representative from Patagonia, and the new head of Colorado's outdoor recreation industry here with us today. We are inside Patagonia's booth on the show floor here at Outdoor Retailer. We will talk to all three of them in just a minute, and we will look back at the first, the opening, of Red Rocks this week in Western history. But first, we're going to do the news. We have a quick follow-up to the emergency podcast that we did earlier this week about political interference with the Freedom of Information Act at the Interior Department. We are now starting to see stories that show just how pervasive that interference was. Miranda Green, who's a reporter at The Hill, discovered that a response to one of her FOIA requests for documents was held up by over a month after a lawyer at Interior named Hubble Relot asked the National Park Service to delay releasing those documents. Even more concerning, though, it appears that documents that were clearly responsive to her public request were not provided to her. She was looking for records that were leading up to the departure of Dan Wenk, who was the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park, who was forced out by the Trump administration. After Green realized what had happened, she called up Dan Wenk. He said that he sent a 3 or 4 page memo outlining every conversation he had leading up to his departure. And that memo was not in any of the documents provided to The Hill. Interior did not have an explanation for what happened. So there is now bipartisan concern over all of this. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas told CQ Roll Call that all of this, quote, sounds inconsistent with congressional intent. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont went even farther, suggesting that it's time the Justice Department needs to get involved here. So stay tuned, as they say. All right, let's get this party started. As you can hear behind us, we are in the middle of a massive trade show in Denver. It's called Outdoor Retailer. It is really hard to understand the size of this thing until you see it in person. And they do it here 3 times a year. I was honestly blown away the first time I came to OR when it first came to Denver. I want to introduce our guests, starting with Nathan Fay. He is the brand new director of the Colorado Office of Outdoor Recreation. Nathan, I know this is one of your craziest weeks of the year, so really appreciate you taking the time and coming by this week.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Aaron.
We also have Angelica Rubio. She is a member of the New Mexico House of Representatives from Las Cruces.
Welcome. I was about to say welcome, but welcome. No.
We'll say welcome, and you can,
thank
hello.
You. No, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
And Megan Wolf is the Environmental Activism Manager for Patagonia. She's based out of Reno, but also here in Denver this week.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So this is a trade show where folks who make outdoor gear show off all of their stuff to the folks who sell outdoor gear. None of you, as far as I can tell, actually make or sell gear as part of your immediate job description. So very quickly, why are each of you here today? And we'll start with Nathan.
Well, I have the luxury of being, this is my state, right? So we have the Outdoor Retailer here in Denver. We're happy to have the show here. But I'm not a manufacturer. I represent a much bigger industry. So it is the manufacturing space that is the economic development aspect of the industry. And that's one of the focuses of my office. But it's also good to be here and partner with the brands and the industry as a whole as we explore the intersection between economic development and the brands itself with conservation and stewardship and improving public health and wellness and safety in our public lands and waters. And looking at ways to improve our talent pipeline through workforce and education.
All right, Angelica, what brings you to Denver this week?
The reason that I'm here, and I apologize because I'm just recovering from a massive cold, is, and so my voice isn't as sexy on the radio as I'd like, but I'm here mostly because I was invited by many of the folks from the outdoor industry who are very much excited, as they should be, about the country's first ever outdoor equity fund, which passed our New Mexico State Legislature this past session in conjunction with the first with our Division of Outdoor Recreation. And I'm here mostly because I want to have an opportunity, and I've been provided a space to talk about what the work that we're doing in New Mexico around equity, around diversity and inclusion, to many of the folks in the outdoor industry who I believe are sort of coming to, I guess, really getting to the understanding that in order for them to have a really good business and to really be a part of all of this nationwide, that they have to actually expand some of the things that they're working on to actually include those of us who are really committed to issues around equity. And so I'm really here to see what this trade show has to offer, but also what kind of commitments can we get from the outdoor industry to not just say that they're interested in equity, but to actually do something for equity.
And Megan, it's obvious why Patagonia is here, but why does Patagonia bring the environmental activism team along?
Well, Patagonia, we are in business to save our home planet. We sort of doubled down on our new mission statement, and we've long had a robust activism program, and what that means, it includes campaigns, grants, and our employee activism. And so one of the things that I do is oversee our wholesale grants program, the means by which we give money through our dealers that sell our stuff to the nonprofits in the field. So we firmly are in business to help the groups that are doing the work, that are on the ground in the field, working to do conservation and protect our lands. And so this is an opportunity for me to get together and meet with those groups, some of those groups that are here, talk about our campaigns, look for more opportunities, hear about the work that those nonprofits are doing, as well as talk to some of our wholesale businesses who are aligned with us on this and want to do support groups in their communities as well.
I want to go back to Nathan. You worked for years to protect rivers in Colorado and around the West. You are now, instead of protecting, you are promoting the outdoor recreation economy in Colorado. How important is the industry as a whole, as an economic driver to the state compared to other industries?
The industry as a whole, I'm a little tongue-tied when I think about the numbers, right? I mean, we are over a $60 billion industry here in the state alone. It's 10% of our gross domestic product. We employ over 500,000 people, you know, nearly a fifth of our workforce in the state. It's not insignificant. And it's not just the manufacturing space, right? It's also the service providers, the guides and outfitters. It's the ski industry. And I think we can cast a really even bigger net when we factor in hotels and restaurants. But to be clear, this office is not in the business of marketing. You know, we partner with the Colorado Tourism Office, for example, to do that kind of work. But we are very much interested in inviting people to come explore the outdoors. Our mission is to encourage industries, people, and communities to come to life in Colorado. And marketing is just a part of that. It's also making sure that we're taking care of the places that we play and taking care of the attributes that make Colorado such a destination.
And Angelica, New Mexico's Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry just came about, and I understand you were part of that process. How did it happen, and what are the goals now? What did it take to get it over the finish line?
In New Mexico, the outdoor industry is already on its own without a division at a $9 billion. It's already a $9 billion industry, and so we already have a very good foundation for expanding, particularly when it comes to economic development. And so last year, at the height of the governor's race in New Mexico, there was a lot of talk about outdoor recreation and an outdoor industry. And many of us who work on issues of social justice, racial justice, and those of us who really believe in conservation and preservation of our land and our culture and our people, we're really concerned about some of the conversations that were being had, and we felt that in order for the Division of Outdoor Recreation to be successful, we needed to do it in a way that was well reflected of New Mexico and who we are as a people and our culture. And so many of us, particularly a couple of a really good friend, Gabe Vasquez, who's our city councilman down in Las Cruces, but is also with has been doing a lot of work around conservation for several years now. Him and I got together one day And I've said this before over vodka, it's always very, very helpful, that we came up with this really great idea of, like, what would it mean to not only create this division of outdoor recreation, but also work towards it benefiting young people and creating a new generation of stewards of our land, so that it's not just about bringing tourism in and having them enjoy our land, but to actually have our own really have access to the public lands. New Mexico has a huge wealth of public lands. We have a huge landmass of public lands, and for our own to be able to access that, I think, was critical. And so we were able to get the governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, when she finally came into power in New Mexico, committed 100% to say, if we are going to create a division of outdoor recreation, I will support it with the outdoor, with an outdoor equity fund. And that happened particularly because over 40 organizations statewide came together, including folks like REI at the national level and on the private industries, and folks like the Federation of Wildlife Federation, who came on board and said, we will not support a division of outdoor recreation unless an equity piece is included. And so it was part of a grassroots movement that we had, and it continues today through implementation.
And so what will that outdoor equity fund do? And what kind of funding levels are we talking about?
So the Division of Outdoor Recreation will live in the Department of Economic Development. We see it as a driver for so much of the economic need that we need in the state of New Mexico. However, the Outdoor Equity Fund will live under the Department of Energy and Natural Resources, under what many of us know as the Youth Conservation Corps. And it will be held there to distribute. It'll be a fund that'll go live July 1st, and it'll distribute funds to nonprofit organizations already providing services to young people across the state, specifically to communities of color, young people of color, but up to 40% of people in the who are considered low income. And these small micro grants will go to them to help pay for things that most grants can't pay for, so like fishing rods, or just transportation to get to and from a public land area. And so all the things that many of our organizations struggle to pay for, this hopefully will help in paying and supplementing so many of those services that so many nonprofits across the state are already doing such good work with.
I love the concept, and it sounds like obviously the kind of thing that will end up being a model nationwide. Megan, as you hear that kind of description, does that align with why Patagonia made environmental activism so much of a priority for a company that could just be in it for profit?
Well, I think it goes back to our founders, Yvon Chouinard, and why when he's climbing and he's at these spaces and learning and seeing some of the destruction that started to happen back in the day. And then when we set up our corporate offices in Ventura, and there's a story behind this where one guy was representing Friends of the Ventura River, and that river was at stake to be channelized, and it was going to disrupt a surf point. And here was the intersection of a recreation that these guys loved. They loved surfing and channelizing the river, which would disrupt the flow. And ultimately, they went to a city council meeting, where this biologist spoke on the fact that this river is still alive and was able to save the river. And so from then, Yvon said, give him an office and a desk, and we're going to fund this group. And then we can, seeing how that grassroots, work was so effective, started to scale that out across as our business grew. So did our commitment. And so, ultimately, Yvon and Craig Matthews started the 1% for the Planet Fund, where we commit 1% of our sales every year to groups. But yeah, seeing that where certain policies, land management policies, can affect, these beautiful places, these are the places where we happen to play and make them less accessible. And so knowing that accessibility and keeping those places protected is important. And it is vital to our business. It's not just our, we've certainly had a lot of success over the last couple of decades, a lot of growth. And that other businesses that are not necessarily outdoor recreation businesses also benefit from the outdoor recreation economy. And I think that's something that we started to look at in Nevada. And so talking to businesses that also benefit from this, whether it's quality of life or, restaurants that attract the people that come and visit. There's just so many avenues that this touches. And that's why, for the first time, I think this sort of movement is taking off. But to go back to your original question, yes, I mean, Patagonia's just been always been committed to protecting the places.
Nathan.
I love that story about protecting the beach break or the break in Ventura, right? It's the odd example of you can't protect what you don't know. And relating that back to the equity fund in New Mexico, I mean, that is the opportunity that is going to introduce a whole new generation, probably beyond just one generation, of folks that have all of these natural attributes out their back door, but they've not had the chance to explore them, to identify with them, and develop a kind of a sense of stewardship or an ethic around those places. So it is so important to create programs like this that advance the experience. And that experience leads into an ethic of conservation and stewardship. And we see that work throughout the industry. And, you know, the example that Megan's providing is one of many that to illustrate that point.
I think the other one we should point out here in Colorado is GOCO, Great Outdoors Colorado. And for folks who aren't from here or aren't familiar, just give a quick rundown of what GOCO does and what its impact has been since it's been around for quite a bit longer.
Sure. So GOCO, the Great Outdoors Colorado system, is a funding mechanism. They receive half of the proceeds from the Colorado Lottery, and then they redistribute that funding to projects on the ground, to NGOs or to local municipalities. And GOCO has had a significant impact in creating new opportunities in the form of, you know, trailheads or river access. It's the attribute, right, that people can go and experience that, again, relates back to this ethic of conservation and stewardship that is so pervasive in this industry.
So earlier this week, the Center for American Progress released a report on policies hoping to boost offices of state outdoor rec. One of the findings in this report is that outdoor recreation contributes more to state GDPs than the mining and oil and gas industries combined. Angelica, to you, how important are numbers like that when you're making the case when you've got New Mexico in the middle of a very large oil and gas boom in your corner of the state?
Those numbers are critical. I believe in so much of the policy work that we're doing. I currently serve as the vice chair for energy, natural resources, and conservation. I am also the chair for radioactive and hazardous materials in the state of New Mexico, because our dependency on extractive industries has been one that has kept us from thinking outside the box for a really long time. Up to 40% of our budget depends and relies solely on extractive industries. And so this past legislative session, when everybody was talking about the surplus and the fact that New Mexico and the Permian Basin is now the number one place to extract outside of like Saudi Arabia, for some people, particularly in the southeastern part of the state, which is considered the oil patch where I was born and raised and where 90% of my family still lives, that is the narrative that keeps getting played over and over again, is that without that industry, New Mexico is nothing. Well, what it's proved to me actually is that we are at the bottom of so many lists across the country. Monday, another report came out that the quality of life for young people we're ranked number one as the worst place for young children. And so when we talk about the Outdoor Equity Fund, or when we talk about the Division of Outdoor Rec and what that can do for our economy, we're not even just talking about what it can do in just that aspect, but it can all how it's going to change the trajectory for so many of our young people who are they're in survival mode. And these numbers are critical to push back on this narrative that we need oil and gas. If anything, what these numbers in terms of the quality of life of children is telling me that oil and gas is not doing enough for its children, and that we need to seriously consider what diversifying our economy looks like, and the outdoor recreation industry is one tool to help in that much very needed area of our community.
So then, looking at some of these numbers, a report in 2018 in Colorado showed that the outdoor recreation industry here in Colorado, in 2013, it was $34 billion. 4 years later, it was up to $62 billion. Obviously, huge growth there. The growth is awesome, but are there also concerns, Nathan, about impacts there to public lands and waters? How do you balance that growth, but also make sure that we are not loving our outdoors to death?
Yeah, that is the heart of the conversations that we're all having right now, right? And I'm not sure that I agree that we are loving the places to death. I think what we are seeing is people don't understand the proper way to experience these places. They don't, you know, the ethic isn't there to, like, you innately know to pick up trash, or you innately know to leave no trace. So it's not that we're loving these places to death. It's just that we're using them inappropriately. And so one of the big initiatives that we're doing at the state is to advance the Leave No Trace ethics. We have adopted our own Colorado principles based on the SHIFT model coming out of the Jackson Hole Conference. And growth is great. You know, we have doubled in 4 years in terms of the number of jobs and the GDP and the size of our industry. Certainly, those are all good things. I think it's going to continue to grow. We don't see the same boom and bust that we do with the oil and gas industry, and New Mexico feels that as well. One of the things that we're grappling with at the state is how do we disperse the use, right? We've got 54 14ers, and they're on everybody's to-do list, right? It's the bucket list to check them all off. But we have all of these 13ers, you know, 13,999 feet. It's the same vista right across the valley. It's the same experience, but there's nobody on that trail.
Right.
So we're looking at all sorts of different ways to, you know, I guess going back to your earlier comment, market that we have more opportunities than just the icons in the state. And the same thing applies to rivers. We see a huge impact closer to our urban areas on the Front Range. Rural parts of the state are very much wanting a piece of this $62.5 billion industry. So we're working across all of these agencies to figure out how we manage the impact, how we improve the ethic, and then what are those tools that we can roll out across the state into these rural communities.
So, Megan, this, I guess, gets into Patagonia, which obviously makes stuff, clothing and equipment. What does Patagonia see as its role, both in terms of minimizing impact through production and also engaging or raising awareness with customers about how to minimize their own impact?
Well, I think that we use our brand muscle, essentially, to talk about the issues that are happening to help engage customers in activism as well. We started a platform called Patagonia Action Works to help our customers get more involved with our nonprofit partners, our grantees, who are doing a lot of work, and there's issues all across the country, and these are highlighted on the platform. Customers can interact with them that way. We do it through our catalog, through our digital media. There's a lot of channels by which we are telling these stories. We use the business to fund these groups and to support our sort of real mission. And so, as far as getting into the supply chain, that's a whole nother area, but we're constantly reviewing, revising, researching how to come out with, you know, what are the fabrics sustainable, you know, what is the impact, and this is sort of an ongoing discussion, but how it relates to our customers. Those stories we're telling, but it's also trying to really interact. So rather than just have it sort of be this one-way communication, trying things that are engaging and involving our customers to also help and support. We also want to inspire and influence other businesses. An Office of Outdoor Recreation can help. I mean, we see that's another mechanism by which we can spread that influence and get other businesses to see how outdoor recreation is important to them, recognizing that. And so then, therefore, those areas need to be protected. So this is where the conservation piece comes in. David Brower said, no, there's no business to be done on a dead planet. And so that's really what it comes down to. We need recognition of how important this industry is, and then mechanisms and funding to help protect and educate. And I think that was a really good point. I use that phrase a lot. Like, the growth is happening. You know, so economic development is a piece of this, but it's growth is happening in Nevada, and so people are loving these places to death. And I feel like Nathan sort of, I have a new narrative now, because it's not that, you know, that they're loving these places to death. It's that we need to really be out there educating, and then to start younger and to really also start with communities that are more negatively impacted especially by extractive industries, and these are the more underrepresented communities. So there's sort of, we could just go on and on. It can move in from there, but there's a lot of ways by which we use that.
I want to talk about some specific places, and starting with Las Cruces, which is the gateway to Organ Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument, one of America's newer national monuments. What has been the impact of that designation on the Las Cruces area, What are you hearing from neighbors, from businesses, from your constituents?
So the Oregon Mountain Desert Peat National Monument designation, we're celebrating its fifth year this year, was an amazing thing that happened to us, not necessarily for just us culturally, but it has been such a great boom for our local economy there in Las Cruces. You know, being New Mexican, we already wear that as a badge of honor. We tattoo it all over ourselves, or we wear our state flag, which is the most beautiful flag. It's been voted as the most beautiful flag many, many years. But it's because we have so much pride for it. And so the Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks National Monument sort of added on to so much of this pride. And we've seen so many different businesses that have come about. They've named their businesses after the Oregon Mountains. Their brand is the Oregon Mountains. We have our Grain Chamber, who believes in terms in economic in making that money, but also in sustainability and being environmentally cautious. That all of everybody is sort of all in when it comes to what the Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks has done for our communities locally. And we hope that it's something that this is a very slow journey, but it's one that I believe is very not only financially prosperous for a lot of people throughout our region, but it's also something that we are very passionate about and that we love.
Nathan, let me ask you then, here in Colorado, folks think Rocky Mountain National Park, hiking maroon bells. Where are the spots here in Colorado that don't get the attention they need? And I guess that gets back to, you know, dispersing impact, if not minimizing it. Where do you think is the next spot that folks should be going rather than you know, climbing another 14?
Sure. Let me put my marketing hat on real quick. It depends on what selection you want to make off the menu, right? I mean, Eastern Colorado is ripe for tourism, but it's a different kind of experience than your 13,000-foot peak or 14,000-foot peak. So there are opportunities for, you know, rivers, trails, road cycling, bird watching. You know, those are places that, are ripe for an investment, basically. And then Western Colorado, you know, we still have these rural communities that have been focused on coal or oil and gas, and they're looking in their backyards, and they've got these wild and scenic rivers in Moffat County. We have a trail system that is not on anybody's radar, but it's world class. And, you know, same with, you know, the western end of San Miguel or Montrose County. We have, you know, coal plants and coal-fired power plants and coal mines being shut down, and communities that are kind of wondering, what are they going to do for the tax base that they lost? You know, 80% of their tax base is gone. And now but then they're looking around and saying, we've got all of this fantastic rock and slick rock and canyon country, and we're no different than the Fruta. So we have this natural capital that we should be leveraging. And those are the places where it's going to happen.
Coming back to the economic impact of outdoor recreation, the most recent data from the Outdoor Industry Association shows the outdoor rec industry as a whole contributes $887 billion to the economy every year. It feels like we're in a moment where there is growing awareness nationwide, Megan. And I'm curious if you think you've seen a change in the last couple years in terms of Patagonia's footprint or impact when it comes to Patagonia's environmental and activism work.
If you mean, have we seen an increase
in awareness around your work or the effect that it's having?
We have seen an increased awareness around our work. You know, there's some initiatives that we've taken, such as when the administration wanted to shrink the national monuments, and we took a bold step to sue the administration. Again, we felt like that was an attack on public lands, which are for all U.S. citizens. And so all of us here, you know, that play and recreate and feel like that someone has to step up. And because of our, I guess, strength in the industry and the success that we continue to experience, we feel our customers supporting the positions that we've taken. And each time we've done things like this, it's been a positive result for us. So it's not, you know, I think that that's just a part of, it's woven into the fabric of our, you know, of who we are, sort of DNA as a company. That again, it goes back to like, this is really why we are in business, and everyone who works here contributes to that. And so when there are policy decisions made, we're stepping up more to take action and getting more engaged.
$887 billion is a huge number, 2.2% of our GDP. Your question is that getting traction? And, you know, I look at the work that Megan's doing with Nevada to build an office of outdoor recreation. Same thing in New Mexico. We have the confluence of states, and we see more and more states turning to form these offices of outdoor recreation so that they can, within their own, you know, their own abilities, grow their slice of that pie, or grow the pie, the size of the pie, so that we can all share it. And it's, I think what we're seeing is increased interest, not just in the West, it's national, and increased interest in coming together to really start to direct changes on national policy.
Let's switch gears for a second. I want to ask about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. I know Patagonia has been involved in some of the fights to try and ensure full funding. It was reauthorized by Congress, but funding is still up to Congress right now on a year-to-year basis. There was a hearing in the House today to try and move ahead a bill to ensure permanent funding. Each of you, to the extent that you're aware or have encountered LWCF projects and impacts in your state, how much are you aware of the importance of that program, and what do you think about the prospects here in terms of full funding and what happens if that makes it through Congress? And it looks like Angelica has something to say first on that one.
You know, LWCF is very, very critical, particularly to communities of color and folks with very little resources, because there are parks, even just in places like Las Cruces and in many of our rural areas across the state, where many of these parks where people recreate, they have been created because of this fund. And so it is crucial that this fund, not only, we did a lot of work around it with many of our partners to not only fight for it to get reauthorized, but to really push the federal government to understand that, and we think we can get bipartisan support for it, is that because everybody throughout every state around the country has benefited personally by what the LWCF has done for their own communities. And so I think it is really crucial that as we're talking about equity, that we're also talking about why it's so critical to also push for reauthorization and enough funding for it.
Nathan?
Sure. I mean, there isn't a single county in Colorado that hasn't benefited from an LWCF-funded project. It has a huge impact. And having permanent reauthorization is good. Having 900, you know, having that fully funded will give us a whole different set of resources to do really good things for youth engagement, for improving our talent pipeline, for conservation of our urban parks and revitalization of our rural communities. It's a priority, I think, for this industry.
Yeah, I think this is a fund that I had not, 2 years ago, I did not know what that acronym stood for. Now I understand it completely, and I think that it's definitely benefited Nevada in the same ways that you all have talked about. It's an incredible use. And I think the bigger question in my mind was, you know, what kind of communities do we want to create? What kind of country do we want to have? And, you know, we've long loved our wild spaces and our wilderness areas, or our lakes, our parks, all of this. And so this fund does, it contributes to all those things that these guys just mentioned. And it's not a very partisan issue. It's largely, you know, bipartisan, something that we can agree on. These are the kind of communities we want to build. So the next step really is that fully funding. So it's great to have it authorized permanently. Now we need to make sure that it's fully funded.
I want to give Megan the last word, because she was so kind as to lend us Patagonia's space on the floor today. Looking ahead 4 or 5 years down the road, how does the outdoor industry as a whole take its activism and policy work to the next level? What does that look like?
Gosh, that's a...
It's a small one, I know.
That's something that we're talking about now more and more, and especially as these offices are coming into place. Okay, now then what exactly are they going to do, and how are businesses going to be a part of that? And I think what's happening is the nonprofits and the conservation groups have long been at the table, have long been lobbying and visiting representatives. Now it's time to really push the businesses to show up and to share their voice, because there is this economic argument. Now it directly relates to that, you know, we have to have these places protected. So to bring the businesses to the table and to, you know, interact with the legislators and the push for policies, to really get engaged and to commit to understanding that this is a part of our operating costs, if you will. Without these places, you know, we can't be as successful. And I think more and more businesses are coming to the table.
Angelica, same question to you then. Now that you have this Office of Outdoor Recreation in New Mexico and the Equity Fund, how do you see this transforming New Mexico's economy in the next 5 years?
I think right now what's really critical is we're in the implementation phase and we're working really hard. We're right now... there's a search for a director to oversee the division of outdoor recreation. A new executive director was hired just recently to oversee the Youth Conservation Corps, which will then oversee the Outdoor Equity Fund. And so those two roles are going to be critical in making sure that the spirit of the fund is kept. And as we move towards this idea of what it can do for our economy, I think it's people like myself and others who are very much on the ground doing a lot of this work and really speaking to those who are directly impacted by what the outdoor industry could do is being able to share those stories and to be able to share those stories with those who are essentially profiting off of this outdoor industry economy, but also how can we use like big ideas which already exist right now. As I mentioned, we do have an industry right now in New Mexico, but how do we help those who've already been doing their work in the business to help them flourish, but also to have all these new really cool ideas really come to fruition with the idea of making sure that conservation and preservation is at the center and really making sure that the traditions that we hold dearly to are intact.
Nathan, same question to you. 5 years down the road, how has Colorado's recreation economy evolved?
I think we will see this industry create very innovative programs that protect recreational landscapes, protect water in our rivers, because we are a headwater state. We've got to do that. It's critical to the growth of the state as a whole. And I think that my crystal ball also tells me that in 5 years, there's a very good chance we will have 51 offices of outdoor recreation in this country. We will be innovative as an industry as a whole, where we will create programs that we're just now starting to talk about that will affect all of us. And we will have a much louder voice in national policies and here at home and in D.C.
Nathan Fay is the director of Colorado's Outdoor Recreation Industry Office. Angelica Rubio is a New Mexico state representative from Las Cruces. Megan Wolf is an environmental activism manager at Patagonia. Thanks so much to the three of you for this great conversation to get today. Stick around for 1 minute because we always like to wrap up the podcast with a look back at this week in Western history. And since we're kicking off this podcast tour in Colorado, we're going to remember the birth of one of the most legendary concert venues in the world, which is, of course, Red Rocks. It was the brainchild of John Brisbane Walker. He was the publisher of Cosmopolitan magazine. After he sold Cosmo to William Randolph Hearst in 1905, he decided to produce a series of concerts on a temporary platform that he put up between the rocks in Morrison, Colorado. In 1909, he even built a funicular train to carry tourists up to the top of Mount Morrison. In 1911, a renowned opera singer named Mary Garden sang there. She declared Red Rocks the finest venue she had ever performed at, and that really put Red Rocks on the map and across the country. At the time, the Natural Amphitheater was known first as Garden of the Angels, and then Walker renamed it the Garden of the Titans when he took over. It was always unofficially referred to as Red Rocks, and then it became official when the city of Denver bought the land from Walker for all of $54,000 in 1927, which would be about $800,000 today, which is kind of nuts, even when you think about that in relation to what land goes for that part of Colorado right now. Construction on the amphitheater started in 1936. Labor materials came from the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA. And then on June 15th, this week in 1941, Red Rocks officially opened. The first notable rock show at Red Rocks was the Beatles in August of 1964. And notable, perhaps, because it was the first show on that legendary U.S. tour that did not sell out. You could have walked up to the gate and seen the Beatles at Red Rocks for all of... Anyone want to guess how much did tickets go for? 1964, see the Beatles at Red Rocks.
$8.
$2.50.
$6.60.
Oh, so close.
Very, 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 yeah, real good. Now, to be fair, eyewitness accounts say that Red Rocks apparently had never been more full than it was that night, so it may just be that a fair number of fans walked in without paying. Rock shows after that were actually banned for 5 years, starting in 1971, after 1,000 people showed up without tickets to a sold-out Jethro Tull show. They set up an overflow area for the fans. They tried to crash the gate. The cops fired tear gas. The tear gas wafted onto the stage. Rock shows came back in 76. Of course, it was a favorite of the Grateful Dead. Fish ended up banned from Red Rocks after a riot outside, after the second of a four-night gig in 96. Morrison just couldn't handle a band with a following that big that followed along everywhere. Fish was not invited back to Red Rocks until 2009. So I'll open it up here. Any favorite bands at Red Rocks or any band you would absolutely kill to see there?
For me, it would have been the Beatles.
I think it would be Fish for me. Yeah. I saw Widespread Panic there in 97.
Nice.
So that was excellent.
I'm drawing a total blank. I mean, I'm still kind of thinking that we need to rename the park again. We used to be so creative.
You know what you're going to get, though. I mean, it's totally as described, right? Okay. So all that, just a tiny bit of the musical history that has been made at Red Rocks, which opened 78 years ago this week in Western history. And that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Thanks again to Nathan Fay, Angelica Rubio, and Megan Wolf for joining us. Megan gets extra thanks for hosting us here in Patagonia's space on the Outdoor Retailer show floor. I also have to give huge thanks to Lauren Bogard here on the CWP team, who is doing the heavy lifting on this road tour. I just show up and read some questions. Stay tuned for details on some more live shows that are coming up later this summer. Send us your ideas and feedback to podcast@westernpriorities.org. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another interview from here at the show with author Heather Hansman. She solo rafted 730 miles down the Green River and turned that into a book that is equal parts adventure memoir and a look at the future of water across the West. In the meantime, I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.